You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I think the work of the last 15 years as a filmmaker has been, okay, now this is where the influence stops, and this is where Barry Jenkins begins. And this project gave me just the greatest palette to express that.
So when do we stop ripping off Siskel and Ebert and start doing our own thing?
Know your limitations, Josh. That's director Barry Jenkins talking about his much-praised new film, Moonlight. This week on the show, my conversation with Jenkins and one of the film's stars, Naomi Harris.
You just had to get a question about Skyfall in there, didn't you?
Like, I'm supposed to pretend I'm not talking to Miss Moneypenny? Come on.
That interview plus some thoughts on a couple of new releases, including Marvel's Doctor Strange, ahead on Film Spotting.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
I'm really looking forward to your tepid recommendation of Doctor Strange a bit later here, Josh.
What a tease.
Plus, we'll get to my recommendation, not at all tepid, for an inventive new doc from a first-time feature filmmaker.
One of those sounds like a Golden Brick nominee.
Maybe. All that is later in the show, and podcast listeners will get part three of our Luis Buñuel marathon, the Spanish-born auteur's 1956 film, Death in the Garden. But first, the hits just keep coming here, Josh. We've had some great guests lately. Kelly Reichert a few weeks ago, followed by Ty West, helped us get through our top five childhood movie scares last week. And now, my conversation with Moonlight director Barry Jenkins and Naomi Harris, one of the film's stars, yes, Miss Moneypenny, from the last couple of Bond films. Moonlight is set in 1980s era Miami. It's based on an autobiographical story by playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney. Jenkins and McCraney didn't know each other, but they actually grew up in the same Miami neighborhood with single mothers, both of whom struggled with drug addiction. In the film, Harris plays Paula, the crack-addicted mother of the film's protagonist, Chiron. Chiron is played at different ages by three different actors. In our conversation, Jenkins talks about how he went about casting those three very different-looking actors, about how foreign films influenced his style, and how he has football to thank for his filmmaking career, and not in any way you might imagine. Harris as well talks about the relative challenges of physical and emotional stunt work. First, though, a clip from Moonlight. In the scene, Harris confronts a stranger who has brought young Chiron, nicknamed Little, home after he failed to turn up after school the previous day. The stranger, Juan, is played by Mahershala Ali.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15th. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Be good that way. But
Barry, I'll start with you. Medicine for Melancholy was a movie that certainly earned some acclaim. I remember it got generally very favorable reviews, but the response to this movie, Moonlight, seems to be its own kind of whirlwind. Do you have a sense of what it is that audiences are connecting with so strongly? And is it the same thing as what drew you to the material?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really the movie's very personal, you know, and I think people just sort of they identify with, you know, how specifically we sort of engage Chiron's struggle, you know. And it's not this thing where what Chiron goes through is relatable to everyone. I think people see just how deep we dove into that one character, and they go, oh, you know, I wish someone could dive that deeply into me. You know, they see themselves in the character. They don't see everyone in the character. And I think in that one-to-one exchange, the movie is just spreading, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to get too personal, but what do you see in the character?
Well, you know, for Chiron, you know, Naomi sitting next to me, and to be brutally honest, you know, when I first read Terrell's piece, which was written here in Chicago, actually, when he was an undergrad at DePaul, Naomi plays this character Paula, who is a composite of my mom and Terrell's mom. And so I could just relate to Chiron as a kid who was watching this person who he loves, you know, go through this just terrible ordeal.
And Naomi, speaking of your character, Paula, as viewers, we make certain assumptions and judgments about her, I think, before we even meet her. If her son is so determined not to go home and to hang out with these total strangers, we wonder how horrible his home life must be. Mm-hmm. When we do meet her, we recognize she may not be perfect, but she is caring and she is protective like we expect a mother to be. There's a decline from there. But how did you go about not judging this incredibly flawed character?
I didn't, I think, initially. I think that was my biggest discovery, actually, when I took on the role. I thought initially that I didn't want to play Paula. I had some resistance to playing her because I wanted to portray positive images of women and positive images of black women in particular. But actually, once I started researching the character, I really realized I had to be honest with myself that a lot of the resistance was about my own judgment about addiction. I'm miss control freak. I'm teetotal. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't even drink coffee. So I had a real problem wrapping my head around what drives someone to have an addiction to something like crack cocaine. And it was a wonderful journey where I had to learn deep compassion. Well, first of all, understanding, and then deep empathy for Paula's choices.
Yeah. And without spoiling too much of the movie and the journey Paula goes on, did you come to see her journey as a positive one?
Absolutely. I think it's a shining example of how, you know, you can only give to others what you have received yourself. You know, if your love tank is empty because you didn't receive what you needed as a child, it's very difficult to give that to another human being. Also, another human being that's your child, because often your child is, you know, your child is an extension of yourself. So I think your self-loathing, and Paula has a lot of that, is taken out on your child, because when you look at them, you see yourself. So until you heal that relationship with yourself, I think it's very difficult to love another human being.
I think that really comes through in particular in one scene, kind of at her worst moment, where she says, almost in a haunting way, but also in a loving way, that you're my only and I'm yours. There is that reflection back in those characters. So what's more challenging than shooting a Bond film in Istanbul with all these action scenes, or playing someone so opposite who you really are?
I would say Bond, actually.
Yeah.
What?
Yes. Because of all the stunts. Yeah. They're just completely different challenges, aren't they? It's challenged in a completely different way.
Well, so I guess the more serious version of that question is, why is it important to you as an actress to take both kinds of roles, these big action spectacles, but do these smaller, more intimate movies as well?
Because I'm ultimately interested, both as a performer and as an individual, in growth and learning. I think that in life we often play one character, and actually we are made up of multiple characters that usually most people don't get to discover. And I think the joy in acting is discovering all those different parts of yourself. And that's what acting allows you to do. And if I play varied roles, then I get to exercise those parts of myself that I never knew existed.
Barry, I wanted to ask you about the influences, because I know you've gotten this question a lot at the Chicago Film Fest Q&A after the movie. You threw out the three movies that you said had the biggest influence on the style of this film, Beau Travail, Three Times, Happy Together. And I think you can definitely see those influences in the film in the way that it's quite lyrical. It's certainly not focused on gritty realism necessarily. And the moments that, as I reflect back on it, that stand out to me in the movie are actually just those. They're moments. They're the moments that you kind of draw out or heighten or return to. They're kind of moments that these tableau kind of moments that almost take you out of time and space. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was appropriate because I think those are the moments we remember from our childhoods. As we reflect back, we think of those. We forget a lot, but we remember just certain images and certain sounds.
Yeah, and as a person who has, you know, kind of found their voice through creating visual storytelling, you know, through images, you know, it was something Terrell and I always discussed this project as sort of being like a fever dream. You know, mm-hmm. I said to him, "You've taken memories of my memories and sort of like presented them as this fever dream." And I feel like in the film, you know, I wanted the audience to experience, you know, what Chiron is experiencing. And he is almost like he's a participant in his own life. But at some point, his consciousness sort of like, you know, it sort of gets away from him, you know, and it takes on this heightened quality, mm-hmm. you know. And I wanted to find a way to translate that, you know, in a way that the audience can experience what the character is experiencing.
Yeah. And that notion of it being a fever dream, it reminds me of what Terrell said about having written this script or written this play and then realized that he couldn't really stage it. You obviously saw something cinematic in the material. What was it?
Yeah, right away. You know, it was partly because, you know, as a filmmaker, I've never made anything that was like personal in this way, but which I mean, that was like at the foundation of how I grew up, where I grew up, when I grew up. And Terrell's piece gave me the opportunity to do that. And because of that, it's like a one-to-one sort of like translation. It's like, oh, I know exactly what that looks like and what that feels like. I don't need to travel, you know, 2,000 miles to Miami to know what that corner feels like. I've been there, you know, and in a beautiful way. It then took this filmmaking voice I've developed, which is absent from my home environment where I grew up. And now I can, I think film has given me a chance to speak about, you know, the way I grew up in a voice that I didn't think myself capable of, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the converse happened where now my filmmaking voice has been elevated because I know this world so viscerally.
The films that you mentioned as influences, are those films that you came to through film school and kind of later as you got into cinema, or were they some of the films that really turned you on to cinema in the first place?
You know, the two things happened at once. You know,
yeah.
I wasn't in love with cinema at all growing up. I didn't really care that much about movies. I kind of stumbled into it after I was already at Florida State doing my undergrad in creative writing. And I'm a big football fan, and there just happened to be a film school in the football stadium. That's where the film school was at Florida State. Yeah, so I was going to a football game because they rebuilt the stadium, and I think out of guilt, they had to put something there that wasn't football related, and that was the film school. And so I thought, oh, I kind of like movies. I'll check this out. And I saw right away that the movies they were watching were sort of informing their aesthetic, and I thought, I want my aesthetic to be, you know, like unique, and so I'm going to watch nothing but foreign films. And some of those films are the movies I watched as I was first falling in love with filmmaking. And I think it's not a surprise that my voice has been heavily influenced by those things. And I think the work of the last 15 years as a filmmaker has been, okay, now this is where the influence stops and this is where Barry Jenkins begins. And this project gave me just the greatest palette to express that. Mm.
Naomi, at that same Chicago Film Fest Q&A, Terrell mentioned one of the central questions in the movie being, am I a man? What kind of man am I? What defines me? Is it my sexuality, how tough I am, how I look? But I recognize, I think, that identity struggle doesn't just apply to the boys here. There's a certain expectation placed on women like Paula as women to be a certain type of mother. And there's a lot of baggage associated with that I don't know that most of us think about every day, but probably should.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really interesting question, which I haven't actually...
In the form of
not heard that question. We have never gotten that question.
I apologize.
My mind is spinning. Like,
I was like, that's a good question. What do you think, Naomi?
What do you think, Barry?
I think the question is getting at something that's really interesting, which is all these characters have a full life. It's like the iceberg theory from Hemingway. Because of the pace we tell the story at, Chiron's iceberg, we do reveal all these things beneath the surface. It's a part of the character. He's pushing everything down. And we're like, okay, we're going to take you down there. Mm-hmm. And we want to see the rest of the iceberg. I think with a character like Paula, You know, we're not privy to those things, but I feel like it's in the performance. And I think when we meet her in that very first scene on that porch, mm-hmm. you can see all these pressures, all these things, you know, that she has to be, mm-hmm. both for herself and yeah. for Chiron. And it's a lot to deal with. And mm-hmm. I think it's part of the reason why, you know, the sort of addiction overcomes her, you know? Mm-hmm. I think there's so much weight.
And I think that weight is there because actually that's a good point about mothering mm-hmm. because it takes a community to raise a child. And ultimately what Paula is trying to do is do it on her own because she's surrounded by so many negative influences. And on top of that, she doesn't have the personal resources to be able to do that. She hasn't right. had the good parenting model that she needed to be able to parent her son on top of all of that. Mm-hmm. So well, I think it's
And I just love that we're in a world where, and she has a boy, you know, who mm-hmm. is not going to be embraced by everyone in the community for certain stigmas.
Yeah. And that moment that you have, really one of the most powerful scenes in the film where you have a confrontation with Juan, that's kind of the undercurrent of that whole scene is mm-hmm. that it's very easy for him to judge and mm. suggest that you should be a certain type of mother, but he doesn't actually have the responsibility.
Yeah, I think it's partly that, and I think it's also partly because that's an example for me of how Paula has been let down by men so mm-hmm. often in her life mm-hmm. In the past that she can't accept any form of help because yeah. she's not used to having any. And if anybody does offer help, it's always because they've got an angle. They want to take something ultimately. So she's very suspicious at that point
yeah.
because she's like, what's going to come next? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want from my son?
Right. I want to ask Barry about the casting and the directing of the three actors who play the three incarnations of Chiron, Alex Hibbert, Ashton Sanders, Trevante Rhodes. But I first want to ask you, I think you're the only direct link between those three characters in terms of seeing you in all three stories. What was it like for you having to maintain some continuity emotionally and psychologically opposite those three different actors?
I mean, I didn't really find that difficult because, you know, I had to have done that research beforehand and known Paula's arc and journey and her history and so on. And I just brought that to bear in each of the chapters. But I think it really did help having Chiron played by different actors mm-hmm. because my relationship with my three sons in those three stages is fundamentally extraordinarily different because Paula's in such a completely different emotional state. It's not just that they've changed,
right.
it's because she's almost, you know, she's changed dramatically in each of those chapters. So I think it helped.
I was shocked to hear you say, Barry, at that Q&A, that you didn't have those actors interact with each other, didn't watch footage of each other. It really was shocking to me just because they're not only similar in appearance, but they're similar in their physicality, in their demeanors, how they hold their heads when they're silent, which is a key part of these performances. I would have assumed exactly the opposite, that you were really meticulous about having them study each other. So how did you pull that off? Because I think it's so crucial that at the end, when we see the character Black, we have to see Little and mm-hmm. Chiron in him, and we do.
It's two words, bruh. Hocus pocus. No. You know, it's almost like Naomi was just saying, you know, so much time passes between each chapter that, you know, I think there's this commentary in the film of how the world shapes us, you know, or how we can allow the world to shape us both for good and for bad. And so I wanted to show or to illustrate in the physical embodiment of this character that the world has made him a different person. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to cast different actors, you know, to play the same person. And I didn't want them to physically mimic one another. You know, I didn't want them to try to carry the performance that came before into their performance. Because, again, I wanted to show just how different the world can make us, how the world can shape us if we allow it. And if we don't have this nurturing, you know, that we see in the first story that isn't present in the second and the third stories. And yet at the same time, there is a continuity, you know, amongst those three young men. And
for
I think
sure.
when we were casting them, we were trying to find this feeling, you know, this soulfulness. Because I think there's this idea of spiritual transference in the film. It's why the swimming scene, you know, is the way it is. You know, there's this transference between Juan and Little in that scene. And I felt like if you could look into Trevante Rose's eyes and you could still see Ashton Sanders, still see Alex Hibbert, that you would feel like this character has changed. Yes, he's a different person, but he's still in there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because, you know, we're trying to create this journey for Trevante in the third story where he is the character's crawled so deep inside and buried himself so deep inside that the work Trevante is doing, aided by, you know, Andre Holland as Kevin, is to slowly dig his way back out to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do that, I thought it would be best, you know, to literally have the character embodied by a different person.
Yeah. How confident were you in your decision to not have them mirror each other at all? Did you ever have doubts about that?
Yeah, you know, so you know, we shot the movie mostly in sequence. You know, we did story one, story two, story three. The only overlap was when Naomi showed up because she had visa issues. We did all her work in 3 days. But other than that, that was the only time, those 3 days, when the main characters jumped. You know, I had to work with all of them. So Trevante shows up and does his first 2 days. And because of the way the shoot was scheduled, his first 2 days, I mean, in Trevante Rhodes, this is radio, I'll say, he is this just hulking, you know, like, you know, 5'11", 220-pound guy, like 2%, 1% body fat, just like ripped.
Yeah.
And his first 2 days, he's walking around in his boxers, like working out, and he's like, you know, on the phone and counting money. And it was like really jarring departure from this real thin teenager, you know, that we worked with before, which was Ashton Sanders, whose shoulders are always drooped. And
right.
He's always like kind of sad and brooding. And I thought, man, did we go too far? Because it was so jarring going from working with Ashton to working with Trevante. And then we did the phone call where Trevante call or Kevin calls and Black picks up the phone.
Yeah.
And it's just Trevante in the room and Andre Holland's voice is actually on the phone. And I can see Trevante just breaking and just so this huge hulking guy, so sensitive and vulnerable. And after the first take, I looked at him, I said, that's why you got the part.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, we're on the right track.
Certainly.
But for those, that day and a half, I was like, oh, man. But then I sit in the audience and I see the audience have the same reaction. He comes on screen and sometimes the audience would go,
yeah.
Like literally, it takes the breath away because they gasp.
Yeah.
This is what the world has done to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. But then when we see him at the diner sitting across from Kevin and we see Chiron in him,
mm-hmm.
in those moments, then I think we gasp again.
Well, and the beauty of this process is, you know, I can only write this thing and get the actors in place and push the button. And then an intellectual idea, you know, a scripted idea, you know, it's given this flesh and blood emotion when somebody like Trevante can actually express that vulnerability, mm-hmm. and sensibility that we don't associate or we don't think someone who's that masculine is capable of.
Just two more quick questions and I'll get you guys on your way. Naomi, the mention there of doing this whole role in just 3 days, is there any advantage at all to having to work that quickly as an actress?
There are many, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because you don't spend hours in your trailer agonizing about what you're going to do, plotting it out in your head. You know, you just have to get on and deliver. And the best place to be always is out of your head.
Mm-hmm.
But the place you always want to go to is your head.
Sure.
I think it actually really helped me doing it in those 3 days.
Barry, last question for you then. Film school, film geek question, because we have a lot of them who listen to the show, people who are just really getting into film or who are aspiring filmmakers. At that Q&A, you mentioned Walter Murch and In the Blink of an Eye, and that's a book that whenever people write into the show and ask me to recommend books, I read that in film school. It's one of my top five, I always say.
Nice.
But can you just talk about the influence of that book on your visual approach with this film or any other work that you've done, and what other books do you throw out when you get asked that question?
Yeah, the only other book I throw out is a book called Masters of Light, you know, and I would say find the original version. It was this book with a really thin paper book. They interviewed cinematographers about their process,
mm-hmm.
and it's really, really dense. But it will teach you, if you pay attention, some really solid things about the visual approach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean craft to the process, how craft can be elevated or sublimated into art. So that book is the only other one I recommend. As far as Murch, you know, Walter Murch was an editor and sound designer. He worked with Coppola on some of the greatest films in the history of American cinema. And he wrote this book as a thesis statement on what he thought, you know, was the true essence of craft in cinema, which was the eyes of the actors and the eyes being the window into the soul. And literally, he wanted to break down why editorially, when you make a cut, you know, what that does thematically, emotionally to the audience, because you're breaking the link between, you know, the actor and the audience. So for me, I use it for casting, because if I'm close on two actors and they're pretty much neck and neck, you know, the same ability, whoever blinks the less, they're getting the part.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it came into play a little bit on the casting of this
the
film.
The old Michael Caine acting school trick as well.
Yeah, exactly. And because you want to have that continuum.
Sure.
That continuous feeling with the audience. And then, like I said, you know, I knew I wanted to cast three different actors to play Chiron in this film. And what we found ourselves honing in on was, it's got to be in the eyes. You know, it was why casting someone like Trevante Rhodes, I was okay with it, or I was comfortable with it, because I thought he looks so different than Ashton, you know, just because he's so bulked up.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know what, I'm going to have faith in this principle now of my filmmaking process, which is the eyes are the window into the soul. Find the eyes and you'll see the soul. And if the soul is the same, the audience will follow the character.
Thank you both so much for the movie. Thank you for your time and best of luck with it.
Thank you, man.
You're my only. I'm your only. No. You gon' listen.
To who, Ma? Huh? To you?
Who is you, man? I ain't seen you in like a decade. It's not what I expected. But what did you expect?
My thanks again to Barry Jenkins and Naomi Harris. I knew they would be a delight to talk to after hearing them talk for a little bit at that FilmFest Q&A the night before, but they exceeded my expectations, and I was the last stop on their way out of town. I knew they had been locked up in a hotel room all day answering questions from idiots like me, and then they were stopping to see me at the studio and head out. And usually that can mean sometimes they're a little tired and maybe not quite as engaged as even they'd like to be and I'd like them to be. That certainly wasn't the case with them.
I'm really glad that Jenkins brought up cinematography there at the end and mentioned the book Masters of Light, where Dennis Schaefer and Larry Salvato, they have conversations with some of the most noted cinematographers. And Jenkins' comment, too, about how the book explains how cinematography can be a craft that can be elevated to art, because that is exactly what my takeaway was from Moonlight, is watching that actually happen on the screen. This is just a masterwork in cinematography, and Jenkins was working here with James Laxton as his cinematographer. And really, it's not only that the movie is beautifully lit, but it's that the skin tones, particularly the African-American skin tones, are just exquisitely lit in this movie. And I single that out because it's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Even when you're talking about, you know, big Hollywood films with massive budgets, sometimes they don't know how to light all of the actors correctly. And this connects very much with what I think Moonlight is doing on a thematic level as well. There is just this aura of compassion that seeps down from the movie. And obviously, they're getting this a little bit by the reference that the title pulls from, you know, the illumination of the moon. That's a guiding light in a couple of ways for this film. But it really carries through no matter whether they're in, you know, a dark night scene or whether they're in one of the high school classrooms where there's fluorescent lights or wherever they may be. There is such care to make these varied skin tones illuminate, and you can see the texture and the detail. And I think that carries over again to how the movie sees Chiron, how it sees really all of its characters, but particularly him, in just giving this sort of beneficent hue that makes us just fall in love with this kid and ache for him, really ache for him in a way that few movies manage to make audiences do.
Yeah, you mentioned the reference there in the title, Moonlight, and it does come up within the text there of the screenplay, but the story that McCraney originally wrote, the piece he originally wrote that he couldn't stage, is called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And that is such a brilliantly striking central metaphor, like I said, that does come up in this movie, because it sets up exactly what this whole film is about, but in a pretty subtle way, which is that other people are always going to try to define you. They are going to see you how they see you within a certain moment, and you may not be able to escape the way they see you. It is ultimately on you to define yourself. And as simplistic as that might be, there's nothing simple about this film or about the performances. And one of the things that I was really glad Barry Jenkins said in my conversation there in praise of Harris, he mentioned how we're not privy to a lot of information about her, but it comes through in her performance. And that's so true. And that must be so hard for any actor or actress to pull off. But I felt like I knew her entire backstory. I understood her relationship with men. I understood her problems as a mother raising this boy just from the performance. No flashbacks, no other dialogue to spell it out. It really does all come through in the experience of watching the performance.
And she does have the benefit, as you mentioned in the interview, of appearing in each of the three sections. Mm-hmm. So not she doesn't have huge part in each of those, but she does appear and makes a large impact in those scenes that she has. But really, every actor we see manages to make the most of their time on screen. And there's
without a
continuity, as you guys talked about, among the three actors playing Chiron and how they manage to capture things that are similar in each mm-hmm. section, but also make him distinct in each section. I think the through line, again, is the cinematography. When we see him in the same literal light, we connect him
yeah.
as being the same person. But I also want to take time to praise Mahershala Ali because that was the performance that I don't know why just and it's devastating when he disappears from the narrative.
Yes.
And you feel that absence in the other segments that he's not in because he makes such an impact in that first segment. And not because he gets any grandstanding scene. Mm-hmm. He's almost in the background, so quiet as this drug dealer who takes young Little under his wings. And at
right.
first, he's almost, you wonder, is this a wolf in sheep's clothing? We're trained by other movies,
yeah.
right? More than anything else to think this is a bad situation.
He doesn't tip his hand either way.
No, he does not. I mean, you still get a sense that maybe this could go wrong mm-hmm. near the end, even after you've seen him and really feel that his protection is genuine. There's that gorgeous scene where he takes Little swimming and teaches him how to swim. And I think that's where we finally begin to understand that his interest is genuine in mm-hmm. the boy. But just the way Ali makes these quiet moments hit so hard, again, without pushing any sort of demonstrative personality, you would think as this drug dealer mm-hmm. who runs the block, the temptation would be to go big, right?
Right?
But no, it's just his quiet presence, and it's really one of my favorite performances of the year.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I think that gets back to what I was saying about Harris as well, where she's playing the crack-addicted, negligent mother. We've seen a character like her in plenty of films. We've seen a character like Ali's playing Juan in a lot of films, that drug dealer, even the drug dealer with a heart of gold, which
sure.
he is more or less as we get to know him. But there isn't anything cliche at all about these characters as it comes through in these performances. And Ali's one of those faces where as soon as I saw him on screen, I felt comfortable. I knew I had seen mm-hmm. him before. Recently, I looked up IMDb later, and he's been in a bunch of things, but recently in the Hunger Games movies.
Right.
And that's where I did have his face in my mind. But what about Andre Holland?
Oh,
Andre
yeah.
Holland,
wow.
who plays Kevin. He's
talk about
he's
making
in that
the most of
piece.
Your scenes.
Yeah, that third act of this film. And he's someone, again, I'm watching him going, not only is he remarkable, I could watch him and Ali in their scenes. Just give me a movie that's just those
their
guys.
Their stories, yeah.
I would so watch those films. I'd watch multiple films with those guys. But he was another face that seemed really familiar to me, and I couldn't place it. And then I looked up later, he was in The Nick, the Steven Soderbergh series. And he's another wonderful actor. And I wanted to re-mention the three titles that came up in the interview that Jenkins listed as the biggest influences on this film, because some people may not be familiar with them, or maybe they just went by too fast and they didn't catch the titles. But you talk about cinematography and the craft of that and how that's art. Not a surprise that those elements would come through in this film when those influences were Claire Denis' film, Beau mm-hmm. Travail, Ho Xiao Shen's Three Times, and then Wong Kar-wai's Happy Together. Now, have you seen Happy Together?
Haven't. Days of Being Wild was the last one I caught up with.
So that's a Wong Kar-wai film I regretfully haven't seen either, but a friend of mine who loves that film and who was at the same Moonlight screening I was and who loved Moonlight said that there's definitely some Wong Kar-wai
clear
Happy Together touches
huh?
there, especially in that third sequence with Trevante Rhodes and Andre Holland. We meet Andre Holland's character first through a phone conversation he's having. We hear his voice and we only see parts of him as he's a cook. He's in a kitchen. We don't actually see his face for a while. And my friend said that that is really something that is mirrored actually in the Wong Kar-wai film. So I did want to mention that for people who love that film as well. A couple other things that came out of the Q&A after the screening that I thought were really fascinating. I just wanted to throw out there. Terrell Alvin McCraney, the playwright and writer of the original piece, was part of the Q&A. And he said something that I don't know that I would have been able to articulate at all, but absolutely felt in every moment of that third act with those actors, those grown-up versions of these characters we've met earlier in the film. He talks about how there's heightened tension and a sense of urgency in there because of the fact that they are what he termed real minutes. And what he was articulating, or what I took away from it, is that he was saying, when you're watching this film that starts with one version of this character in the past, and then we go to another version and we realize that he's older, we know we're watching this construct where we're very aware that this happened in another place and time. And it's almost like it's not really happening now. And when we get to that version of him right now, in the present day, these two characters meet again. Now we know that we're watching them starting a whole new trajectory, and we have no idea where it's going to go. It's where their lives in some way begin for us as viewers, and we have to fill in the blanks. And there is something inherently fascinating about that that does raise the stakes of two people mostly just talking.
Real minutes, was that the phrase?
Real minutes. Used?
Yeah. That's my impression while I was watching it, is what incredible patience on the part of Jenkins to allow this reunion to spread out in what almost feels like real time. There's the phone call to set it up. And then when Sharon, who's now goes by the name Black, shows up at the restaurant to meet with Kevin, he first says hello, and then Kevin goes to serve some other people. Just minute, boring things that I won't go on to describe, except to say that it extends the scene so that it's not that all we get are their conversation together. And even their conversation is interrupted by Kevin having to go do some more work. And that does exactly what you're talking about. It breaks up the pattern of what we've seen before, where they're not vignettes, they're not episodes. We're here with these two in the right now, and that lends it so much more drama.
Yeah, the other part, and this is something I certainly wouldn't have been aware of had Jenkins not expressed it and described it in answer to a question someone in the audience who was aware of this style of music, but what he did with the score here and the music as well, it really comes through in that third sequence. But you reflect back on how some of the more traditional movie score sounds are rendered in this film, where they seem distorted in some way. They seem like they are perfectly in keeping with this notion of a kind of heightened fever dream, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't understand exactly what was being done to the sounds to manipulate them, to make them have that distorted, heightened effect. And what he described is this style of music that came out of Houston in the early 90s, mainly called Chopped and Screwed. And it's where you take hip-hop and you remix it so that everything is slowed way down, and it does have that distorting kind of effect. So we hear that in the songs that are playing in Black's car really the whole time that we are with him. But then you realize that even the oboes and the other strings and things that you're hearing in earlier portions of the film, they have that same technique applied to them to give it that effect.
Yeah, and it's just the use of those classical music instruments altogether where you might not expect it. In the early segment where the boys are just out on the field, you know, roughhousing and wrestling and messing around, we get this lyrical music to it that makes it suddenly seem as if it's something from a Malick film. And I believe the same sort of music accompanies that swimming scene, which is some sort of, you know, baptism moment taking place. And so these are other uses of the usual cinematic techniques in ways that maybe we've seen here or there, but not always applied to a story like this.
Moonlight is out in limited release. It opened here in Chicago just this past weekend, and it is rolling out to more cities this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Not yet election day here, Adam, but let's do some early voting anyway. We'll have the results of the Film Spotting poll, in which we ask listeners to name the best election movie, when we come back. Stay with us.
Ken plays with the heartstrings, late nights in the basement, kills me with them soft notes, offbeat placements, so sweet with the long notes, blue dream in the light glow. I'll wait for the next show, but if you lead, then I might roll. On your marks, when you're ready, let me start. Okay, two shots in the slow dance. We walk to your home stand. Keep up, keep up, keep up if you can. Something different, ain't it? Nothing like we planned. This ain't complicated. Just the nature of a man, product of a good, 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 good. All up in the air, get 'em all up in the air. And if it's love, then it's love. But if it's not love, then it's all love.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least.
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from?
You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they call in the UFO.
A bit of the trailer there for the new film that's been getting a lot of buzz since the Toronto International Film Festival in September from director Denis Villeneuve, one of our favorites here on Film Spotting, at least two.
Favorites to pronounce.
Try to pronounce correctly, which we think we're a little bit better than we used to be these days. It is due in theaters next weekend. And Josh, I know it is one that you are considering discussing on next week's show. I will be out of town most of the week. Won't be here, but certainly listeners will be in capable hands with one Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune.
We hope to do Arrival. I'm really interested in that, but I'm also pushing for a review of Loving,
yeah,
the Jeff Nichols picture that we've been looking forward to all year and has also been getting a lot of good buzz. So I might push hard for that. I know Michael is interested in talking about Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. He mentioned it earlier on the show with us, and he was kind of on the fence about it. I know he's either taken another look at it or had a chance to, so he'd like to work that in. Who knows? Maybe we'll do all three. We'll have to see what happens on next week's show. Listeners, though, if they want to see Arrival ahead of time and get ready for that discussion, they can get some advanced screening passes from us. There's going to be a screening on Monday, November 7. Arrival, as you mentioned, opens on November 11. And we have details for how you can enter to win those passes at filmspotting.net.
Of course, an advanced screening here in Chicago for
Correct.
Our area listeners, our local Film Spotting listeners. And we also had recently some passes to give away to the other film you said that you guys might discuss next week, the Jeff Nichols movie Loving, which is also coming out on the 11th. And we didn't get a chance to promote it here on the show because of the timing, just when that screening was. It was just this week here over the past couple of days, Josh, but we listed it on our website and we will also often put those out on social media as well. So my point here is that it pays to follow us on those platforms. It pays to occasionally visit our website if you are in the Chicago area. Sometimes we do end up having great opportunities to see movies for free before they open here in Chicago, and you can always enter via our website. We also wanted to promote, Josh, not only our big live show coming up with the Film Spotting SVU folks, part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. You can buy tickets to see our show on Friday, November the 18th. Ticket sales are going very well, but there are still seats available. We look forward to seeing all of you out there. More information available at chicagopodcastfestival.org. But we also have another WBEZ Podcast Passport series coming up, and this one is devoted to a topic that, you know, it makes sense. Maybe we were included again in this round, Josh. It is about film. So three Chicago podcasts taping their show live, exploring the world of film. It all starts with the podcast Death, Sex, and Money on November the 14th at the Music Box. So coming up here, if you're interested in this at all, we encourage you to get those tickets as fast as you can. And then Nerdette, our friends at that show, are going to do their thing on December 21st at Victory Gardens. And Josh, we then do our wrap party, our 2016 wrap party in January 2017, Friday, January 13th. And we're going to be at a new venue. The main stage, always been so good to us, no longer available, unfortunately, for our live shows. But I'm really excited to do a show at this new venue for us, the University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts.
Have you stopped by there yet?
No, I haven't. I've just seen pictures.
The pictures are amazing. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it myself. I'm a little intimidated almost because main stage was, you know, a bar venue sort of situation, casual, mm-hmm. and that worked really well. This is like a performing arts venue that we're going to have to raise our game.
We're going to wear our tweed jackets.
We're going to have to dress
very
up,
professorial.
Much more professorial. Start on your beard now. I'm really excited. Yeah, I know. I'll give you a heads up. I'm really excited, though, to try this out. I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah. A passport includes admission to all three shows. It's $50 for WBEZ members, $60 for non-members. And WBEZ urges you all to act fast as their is just a limited number of those passports available. Of course, you can also buy individual tickets to see just our show or just Death, Sex, and Money or just Nerdette, but it was really fun the last time we were part of this with, I think it was our last wrap party.
It was.
To see a lot of people come out who weren't familiar with film spotting, but
yeah,
they bought the passport, so they gave us a try, and they've become fans of the show, and we exposed listeners to other podcasts as well. So again, Death, Sex, and Money coming up November 14th here in Chicago, and we will link to more information about that podcast passport series and all those shows at filmspotting.net in our top stories and also in the notes for this show. Again, that's at filmspotting.net. That's where, Josh, you will also find our poll questions. And assuming you're listening to this the weekend we posted it or it aired on WBEZ, next Tuesday is Election Day here in the U.S. And if you're listening to this after the election, is everything okay? We hope so. A couple of weeks back, we asked you to name the best election movie. And based on the results, Josh, it's possible everyone took that question a little too literally.
By the winner, yes, it does look that way. Here were the candidates we gave you. Bob Roberts from 1992, director there, Tim Robbins. Bullworth from 98, directed by Warren Beatty. The Candidate, going back to 1972, directed by Michael Ritchie, starring Robert Redford. And then we jumped up to Alexander Payne's Election from 1999. The Manchurian Candidate was another option from 62. Milk from Gus Van Sant in 2008. Primary Colors, Mike Nichols' film from 1998, and Other was our last option for you.
And we'll get to some of those write-in candidates here in a moment, but first, the results. Primary Colors in dead last, 3%. Bullworth just ahead, 4%. Bob Roberts, my favorite Bob Roberts, 5%. The Candidate, Robert Redford, 6%, and then Other with 7%. So really bunched together there, really tight voting at the bottom of the pile. Milk, we jump up to 13%, the Manchurian Candidate, 21%, and then the big leap up to the winner of this poll, Election was elected the best election movie, Alexander Payne.
It had a lead early on, right, and really never let up.
No, it did not relinquish its stranglehold on the lead. We heard from Stuart Feldstein in Bondurant, Iowa, a scant 20 miles or so from my hometown, Josh. It's nice to see The Candidate on this list. This is an underseen gem of a film that's still relevant 40 years after its release. I love movies with a punchline, and this movie has one of the best. It's too good to spoil and perfectly sums up in two words the electoral process in America. He's absolutely right.
Tom Labarth went with the other option, had to write in with some love for 1964's The Best Man, with a screenplay by the iconoclast Gore Vidal and starring Henry Fonda as the titular principled candidate. The Best Man uses the backdrop of a presidential primary to explore the way that politics tests and corrupts even the most noble of politicians. It's the perfect film for this election season. The prescience of the themes in Vidal's screenplay is evident when looking at our own political landscape, where the best candidate can be forced to compromise themselves for the greater good.
Yeah, that is one of my big election movie regrets. I look forward to catching up with it here at some point. The other one that I did mention to you and Sam right after we posted this poll, another huge regret for me, is A Face in the Crowd. Andy Griffith in that one is a movie that comes up a lot around election time. Michael Locker in El Cerrito, California writes, big ups to the right in votes for their best man, and perhaps showing my Bay Area bias, I have a real soft spot for Milk. In fact, these are terrific films all around, but my mind quickly jumped to election season level righteous indignation over the absence of Robert Altman's 1975 Nashville, my write-in vote for the 2016 election. Altman's take is set apart by its focus on the odd assortment of entertainers, journalists, and human props which spiral around any election. The sly thesis that the circus of modern politics isn't a cliche, but rather the heart of the matter, might have felt cynical in 1975, but against the backdrop of the 2016 race, it's quaint and sweet. So there you have it. Robert Altman's funny, acid-tongued dig at American politics offered up as a charming diversion from reality. It works on so many levels.
I like that, Michael. One more note here from Eric Howder. I knew that it was a losing battle to vote for Bullworth before ever clicking the submit button, but regardless of the end result, I am satisfied that I've done the right thing if I only felt that way about the real life coming election.
That brings us to our latest poll question, and we struggled with this one a little bit, and it probably comes through in the result. I'm not sure it's one of our more inspired poll questions. We kicked around something related to Thanksgiving, maybe what you're most thankful for this movie season, or even something along the lines of which movie from an indie auteur are you most excited about? We've got Manchester by the Sea coming out and La La Land, and we've already mentioned Arrival coming out on the 11th, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them on the 18th, Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard in Allied, which comes out on the 23rd. So there's a lot of different movies we could have posed in some form of a most anticipated question, but we've done a lot of that here recently, a lot of preview stuff. So we thought, let's just focus on a single holiday film, Disney's South Seas set Moana, starring The Rock. Disney films are not, Josh, usually in our purview here on the show, but this one is a little different. If you think back to my number five question of the fall movie season, I wondered if any of Hamilton's genius will be on display in this film since Lin-Manuel Miranda is doing the music. So our question simply is, Moana is
the movie I look forward to bringing my kids to Thanksgiving weekend, the movie I will reluctantly bring my kids to Thanksgiving weekend, the only Hamilton ticket I can afford. Enough of the damn Hamilton talk. This is a movie podcast. Yes, that one was an option.
Mm-hmm.
And other will give you the other option as well.
I'm really saddened at the thought of how many people are going to vote for enough of the damn Hamilton talk.
It's going to crush you if this wins.
It really will. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net, though I don't want to know what you think if that's how you're going to vote. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from.
If the film is by Wes Anderson, then it will make his list. Or from Pixar or Disney, well, you get the gist. But heavy-handed messages really aren't his thing. Time for Larson Recommends on Film Spotting.
I don't know, do mild recommendations actually warrant the theme music, Josh?
Yes.
It applies?
Yeah, it applies.
Okay.
Because
okay.
There is a certain segment of the listening audience who is intrigued by Marvel films. I know maybe as a show we become exhausted by them, but this is one that I was looking forward to. I had some time off from such films after Suicide Squad. This seemed to have potential, and it has just enough reward, I think. How am I going to convince you, Adam, that Doctor Strange is worth your time? I'm probably not going to be able to, especially if I failed on Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm not going to succeed with something like this. But at the heart of this movie is actually a fairly cinematic idea that the director, Scott Derrickson, and his team managed to pull off inventively and rather thrillingly. It's that this Marvel superhero can bend space and time. And they employ that in the various fight scenes and the confrontations in clever ways. You've seen in the trailer, I'm sure, and early on people were talking about how this is reminiscent of Inception. And certainly there is a little bit of that where the characters can bend buildings and turn streets. The movie actually one-ups Inception at a later set piece where it turns the entire skyline of Manhattan is almost like an inverted Rubik's Cube. So things become even more complicated. And I think Derrickson and the stunt coordinators and so forth, they handle this really well so you know where everyone is and how they're being affected by these changes. And the time element, too, is interesting in the climax, because Strange, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who I haven't mentioned
yet. The Batch.
And yes, there's maybe a reason I haven't mentioned him yet. But in this climax, it's interesting because they're able to rewind what's actually going on this Hong Kong street around the main characters in slow motion. Okay, so it's rewinding in slow motion as the characters are confronting each other in actual time. And there's a certain delicacy to this that you don't always get in superhero blockbusters. Now, the reason that I am tepid about it is I found this to be a storyline, at least how they're handling this variation of Stephen Strange, is pretty much Tony Stark redo. He's a master of his own universe who suffers a great fall. He's arrogant.
He's a narcissist.
And he's a narcissist, and he achieves this power. In this case, it's the mystic arts. And that's how he starts to learn a little bit of humility. So the character arc, the narrative arc is very similar. It also comes to this world-threatening stakes at the end that I've grown tired of, rather than getting personal, like we both felt Civil War did. So those are all to the movie's detriment, I think. But still, in these other elements, it offers something that is at least a little idiosyncratic for one of these Marvel films. And I'll also mention his cape is pretty cool. I better give it the official name, the Cloak of Levitation. This is one of those things when I read about or hear about, because I'm not a comics guy, I'm like, oh, that sounds pretty cheesy. But like the entire character of Tony Stark and Iron Man, they sold me on it. They make it work. And there's a very cool reveal sequence where Strange takes on this Cloak of Levitation and uses it as well. It's almost like a fashion show as a weapon in a fight sequence. So that was a lot of fun. So, yeah, this one has its moments.
It was just chaos.
It's like a battle scene.
There are two different kinds of shots.
Apparently, police are returning the fire now.
Well, Josh, I did not make time for Doctor Strange, but I was able to see a new documentary that is opening at the Music Box this weekend here in Chicago and is rolling out to more cities. It's been on the festival circuit and playing in a few places here and there, and I really hope more people do take advantage of the opportunity to see it. It's called Tower. This is a film for me that is absolutely a Golden Brick nominee. It is a film that chronicles the day in August 1966 when Charles Whitman went up to the top floor of the University of Texas Tower and opened fire. And I've been familiar with this. I knew it was Charles Whitman. It's one of those stories you hear about, especially when similar acts, similarly tragic acts have come up in our country's history. But there was certainly a lot I didn't know about it. And I didn't know when I started the movie that I was going to go through the visceral experience that director Keith Maitland put me through. He was up there at the top of that tower, essentially holding that entire campus and the city of Austin hostage for 96 minutes. And the runtime on this movie is 96 minutes because it really does essentially capture the event unfolding in real time, but from a multitude of perspectives. So you hear from people who were shot, but obviously survived, from students and others who helped some of those victims, from students and others who wanted to help those victims, but didn't. And I hesitate to even use a word like cowardice, because the whole time you're watching it, you're thinking, well, I wouldn't run out there either. You can't see this guy, and the bullets are just flying. And of course, it's sickening to think about someone out there suffering, losing blood, and you want to help them, but are you prepared to be next? That really is the question. You also have some of the policemen on the scene, their perspective, townspeople who played key roles, and even the media covering the events. It is a movie that really does immerse you in that experience. And maybe that doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun, or maybe you even wonder, is that something that I want to experience? And that's all very valid, because I was holding my breath for that entire 96 minutes. But it isn't just about that visceral experience. There is something more human and more powerful at the core of this film that the movie does eventually reveal. I don't want to get into it and spoil it. And I really don't want to say anything more about the movie, other than I'll note that it combines these interviews and some actual archival footage with a rotoscoping technique. So you are seeing animated versions of this entire ordeal, and you're seeing interviews with people who are rotoscoped, because of course the people who experienced this are now much older, and we're hearing from the versions of themselves that existed back on that day who went through it. So they are portrayed by actors and actresses, but then rotoscope. So there is an interesting effect that that has on us as viewers, to be distanced a little bit from the horror because of that, but also to be even immersed even further because we are able to then see things and hear things that we otherwise wouldn't get to see or hear. It is one of the best films of the year in my mind.
It's interesting that this is the second documentary this year that employs animation and one that explores a real life crime, actually, too, mm-hmm. with The Witness and its use of animation. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to catching up with The Tower for sure.
It's interesting that you made that connection because I did as well. One of the things I was thinking about, not just in terms of the animation and the style or the subject matter, and they're very different films overall, but they are also two movies that are about trying to make sense of trauma, that are trying to explore trauma with The Witness. There are a lot of people involved, but it's really about a very personal trauma. And here in Tower, it's a trauma that so many people experience. And I won't get into the details because I didn't know just what the body count was that day in terms of people who died, of the number of people who were injured. And I think it is probably best just to go into this film knowing as little as possible. Doctor Strange goes into wide release this weekend. Tower, as I said, currently playing in limited release. If you get a chance to see either movie and you want to share your thoughts, we'd love to hear from you. feedback@filmspotting.net.
Well, after a week off, we're returning to our Luis Buñuel marathon when we come back with another title from the 1950s, Death in the Garden. Stay with us.
There's no need to wear these shades when I drive. I need to see the leaf before the stride. There's so much more that can happen. I'm sure that you can imagine. I live around here. Let me show you how to walk it, stop the traffic, so say them two legs to get you right for action. But good brain, they get you all the answers. They get you all the cash and fashion. Just pat your lashes and tell me where you wanna go. But I don't really think that it can get much better. The city I love, city I love, city I love. Telling me you wanna break free, I bet you never.
We want to get to some thank yous and some listener comments here, including, Josh, I'm going to bestow upon you a gift that came to us via the Film Spotting P.O. Box.
Okay.
It's definitely something we've never received before. First, we want to mention our featured artist this week. More information at andersonpack.com. That's Pack, PAAK.com. We start our donations off with a bit of thanks for Lewis DeYoung. And Josh, I believe Lewis is out in Western Iowa, so far out that he might as well be in Nebraska, but I like that he's in Iowa. I always love to hear from and get support from my fellow Iowans. Thank you, Lewis. A couple of Silver Club donors this week, Andrew in Washington, D.C., and Jeffrey Butler in Greensboro, North Carolina, though Greensboro and many other locales, some more exotic than Greensboro, North Carolina, no offense to anyone there. We got this wonderful handwritten letter from Jeffrey, and we don't have time to read the entire thing, but we certainly wanted to share a few of his thoughts.
I am a teacher of English to speakers of other languages, and my career has taken my wife and me to different places. Wherever I go, my MP3 player and Film Spotting have traveled with me. It's been a nice companion on international flights, lesson planning in Japan, and on mountain hikes in Korea. This is to say nothing of all the times you've helped me to make weekly chores go by more quickly. It was an extra boon to have your advice when living outside of an English media market. I was able to keep up with the new releases and to know if a movie was worth seeing at a local movie theater or checking out from the local video store. Due to your recommendations, I've also discovered movies that I would not have otherwise seen. These movies include classics such as The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and A Matter of Life and Death, as well as more recent films like Under the Skin and the Before Trilogy. Thank you for adding so many great movies to my watch list. I don't know that I would have seen them, but for a review or a mention on a top five list. Keep up the good work, and thank you again. You're a loyal listener via Japan/Korea and now Greensboro, North Carolina.
Wow, thank you so much, Jeffrey, for the kind words and the donation. We have a new $5 a month donor, Cynthia in Belchertown, Massachusetts, who says, thanks for the terrific podcast. I'm happy to see Film Spotting partnering with Mubi for the current marathon. And Cynthia notes she has no affiliation to Mubi, just a very happy subscriber. A new $10 a month donor, Carl, all the way out in Nacka, Sweden. And we also got this platinum level donation from Scott out in Western Kansas. Very generous donation, and it's not his first very generous donation to the show. But in addition to the money, he he had to throw in something else. So we got this handwritten letter from Scott. Film Spotting crew, here's a belated congratulations on your 600th show. Like many other listeners, I enjoyed it immensely. Please use the donation as you see fit. I still haven't given up on you establishing a scholarship for film students. More on that in a moment. Perhaps you can use the money to start furnishing the Film Spotting Cloverfield Memorial Bunker from episode 578. To begin that effort, I've enclosed two donkeys for the bunker. One is to remind Josh of his love of Bresson's Balthazar, deservedly so. The other is to help Adam differentiate between a donkey and a cow, episode 587.
That's great.
The lobster, right?
Yes.
Be careful, though, and I have no idea what this means, but I'm going to read it. This donkey was bred at the Panemi Magritte School of Thought and is a Buñuel devotee. Keep your eye on him.
Okay.
Okay.
That does sound threatening.
Yes, it does. Finally, one of many blind spots is Dreyer's Odette. After Adam's passionate championing of that film, I plan to see it by the end of the year. As always, I appreciate your intelligent discussions. Take care, Scott from Western Kansas. And he says, P.S., I am looking forward to Josh's book next year. So he's the one, Josh.
Wow. Thank you, Scott. Hey, you got to start somewhere.
That's right.
You have very confused listeners right now because they're imagining live real donkeys. I think it's time you should point out what you're holding there.
Yeah, this is a wonderful stuffed,
it's a stuffed
donkey.
I don't think you'd said that yet.
No, I didn't. I wanted to create the illusion that we had
that we now had livestock
donkeys
in our possession.
Now. Like they were grazing on your lawn, or maybe donkeys don't graze. Those are cows again.
This is something you're going to have to look up.
But you have to read, even though we know the name. Read what it says on the label of your package.
Mon nom est Balthazar.
My name is Balthazar. And mine
so
says,
he hasn't just gotten a stuffed animal donkey.
No.
These are specifically Balthazar and...
My label doesn't have a name. It says, ce n'est pas une âne, which I think means just, I am a donkey. Don't you think that's what that means?
I don't know.
Well, stall while I Google donkey in French, Josh.
I think it means your donkey's named Anna.
Yeah, Anna.
Anna's donkey in French.
And I probably said that wrong, but yeah, so
okay.
I am a donkey.
I like mine better.
I'm going to have to come up with a name now for my donkey. So I love it that we have listeners who are this thoughtful, of course, who are this generous as well. And the mention there of the Film Spotting Scholarship, Scott has donated before, as I said, and he's given big amounts, and he has noted that we can do whatever we want with the money, but he loves the idea, and I've loved it too.
Yeah.
We just haven't pulled it off.
We talked about this before.
Of us figuring out a way to funnel some of this money every year in the form of a scholarship. And so a little bit of an on-air production meeting I'm going to throw out to you. The thing I'm trying to figure out is, do we just go ahead and earmark a little bit of money every year to go to a film student, could be a grad student, could be an undergrad, at Columbia College here in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
because it's our backyard, and I did go to that school for a while. I was an MFA student at Columbia College, so I know what it's like to not be able to afford
sure.
food for your cast and crew and to barely be able to afford another 100 feet of film. So I feel like that would make sense for us to do that. Just $500, maybe even $1,000 every year to a student at Columbia. But then we also have so many listeners from around the world who are in film school or going to film school or trying to finish a film. And I wonder if we need to somehow open it up and have a whole program to award one of those young filmmakers a little bit of money. Of course, that would involve a lot more work.
Well, you know, the other thing is, I don't know about Columbia, how many international students it attracts, but say the school at the Art Institute, the film school there, I know gets international students. And there's also always to go the film studies route. And I mean, the kids who go into that aren't usually sitting on piles of money either. And University of Chicago mm-hmm. here in town has a strong program in that. So I like that you have Columbia ties. That makes a lot of sense. But I think even if we do stick in town, that doesn't necessarily negate helping out an international student.
No. And to be clear, it's not so much about it needing to be an international student. I'm just thinking about all of the listeners we have, no matter
yeah.
where they are.
No,
they
I
could
get
be
it.
In, they could be in Miami, or they could be in Greensboro, North Carolina, who have aspirations to make films or have started making films. Maybe they are in a film program, and why limit it to just Chicago listeners when, yes, we are a Chicago show, but obviously we have listeners in 30 to 40 countries around the world.
There is something nice too, just, you know, knowing how this works a little bit at my alma mater, in being able to establish a recurring scholarship at one place every year.
Right.
I was just at a dinner at Trinity Christian College where you actually had a chance to sit with students who have received scholarships that maybe your family is a part of or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a cool thing too, if there's a way to have a recurring grant or something, and we'd actually get to meet those students because they're in town or do something with them.
And maybe even have a say in who does get the money too, where they funnel some of those candidates to us and we get a little bit of a vote in who we think should get it. Maybe what we can do is do that and keep it pretty simple and have that recurring scholarship set up. But then at some point, we can find a way to branch out. And whether it's through money or just promotion or something else, we can still have some kind of film competition. This is something Sam and I have talked about going back to 2007, where why not have all these filmmakers send in their work and share these movies and have a panel of judges review them and share feedback. That's something we got to get to in all of our free time. We do thank Scott again and everyone else who sent us a donation this past week. And there is, of course, a no-cost way you can help the show. Rate or review us on iTunes. We want to thank the following listeners who posted quick reviews this past week. Hokie 211-21 just started listening to the show and I'm hooked. Glad I found it. Keep up the good work, fellas. Matt Harville, who says, I don't make it to the movies as much as I'd like to anymore, but this podcast has become my film surrogate until I can actually sit down and watch something. Fabric Face, listen to this podcast if you have ever seen a movie or would consider watching a movie. Even if you have never seen a movie, listen in case you decide to. That might be the best recommendation we've ever had. And this final one from, couldn't ask for more, even though Josh is frequently wrong.
Oh, well, at least I take a position, You failed to mention that ends with question mark, exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point, exclamation point. You don't know where you are.
That's right. Fair enough. Thanks to Hokie, Matt, Fabric Face, and everyone else who took the time to rate or review us this
week. Or maybe it's
Hello, on est sauvé? S'il y a des gens, il faut les rattraper, ils vont nous aider.
On ne sait pas à qui on a affaire. C'est peut-être des Indiens sauvages. Ou des bagnards évadés.
Pourquoi penser au pire? C'est peut-être des explorateurs. Des gens de bonne volonté. On va chercher, non?
On va regarder s'il y a d'autres traces.
So Josh, a criminal, a prostitute, and a priest walk into the jungle.
I've heard this one.
I think you have. I think you've seen this one, because that's more or less the setup for the latest film, the fourth film, the third conversation in our Luis Buñuel marathon, Death in the Garden from 1956. It's a film that takes place in a fictional South American country. A group of miners rise up against a fascist government. And I think back to the first question you posed as we started talking about Buñuel in this marathon, you wondered about context and how important that would be, all the social, political, religious references and the various targets in his work. That certainly applies here on the political front, where you could make the case that this movie generally is an allegory for oppression, and more specifically, it's an allegory for the oppression that Buñuel himself witnessed in his home country of Spain under Franco that prompted him to flee to Mexico. I wonder if you felt the absence of that context as you watched this film. But beyond that, just on a pure entertainment level, last time we discussed Robinson Crusoe, a movie that I felt was mostly unsatisfying, but I had a lot to say about it. And here with Death in the Garden, I found it to be a much more satisfying film than Robinson Crusoe, but I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about it. Did you have a similar experience, or did this movie also provoke a strong intellectual response in you the way most of Buñuel's films do?
Oh, I think there's a lot more to think about here than in Robinson Crusoe, and at the same time, it's also much more entertaining. I had a great time with this movie, and perhaps the easiest way to explain that to someone who hasn't seen it and hears that setup and this talk of politics and oppressive regimes, I'm going to put this in a different context and say I felt like I was watching Casablanca during this movie mm-hmm. in terms of the scenario and the figures, the characters at play, the expansive cast and how robust each of the performances are in their roles, the wit that's at play, people who enjoy The African Queen more than I do, another Bogart picture.
Yeah.
I would say it's definitely, yes, it's definitely in that vein as well. So think about those movies in relation to this, and mm-hmm. I think you'll get a good idea of how much it works. Now, of course, it is also operating as this political allegory of sorts, but it isn't overburdening in terms of trying to make one-to-one connections to Franco Spain or anything like that, because it is much more general and universal about a fascist government oppressing the little guy. That's what's going on here. So the politics are really clearly on the side of the miners, and maybe that's not very interesting. What is interesting is when this motley crew heads off into the jungle and Buñuel gets to explore what I think he's mostly interested mm-hmm. in, at least in the films that we've seen, are the hypocrisies that lie in every human heart.
Yeah.
And so we have the priest, of course, is going to be a fraud, played by Michele Piccoli. We see that already in the village, and that's only, it's a little back and forth as they get in the jungle, and we wonder where he's going to go, but in the end, he's exposed.
Well, let me stop you real quick there. You really do feel like Lizardi's a fraud in this film?
By the end, when they're all exposed except for two people, I feel.
Yeah.
When they, we can maybe give this away, but they're on the verge of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, in this desperation, have come together in a way that
yes.
they recognize the end and they're no longer really sniping at each other.
Mm-hmm.
But then they come across this crashed luxury plane and there's food and clothes and jewelry scattered about. And they celebrate together, but very quickly, they start going right at each other's
sure.
throats. As soon as civilization is a possibility mm-hmm. again, they get stripped bare to who they really are.
Still,
and that's where the priest...
Yeah.
Do you remember his last act?
I do. And I think that really does show, without a doubt, a sense of his own corruption. But to say that Buñuel treats him throughout the entire film as a fraudulent figure that we have to immediately dismiss, I think it's one of the least cynical portrayals of a religious figure we've seen in his film
so far,
or that I've seen.
Well, that's probably true. He gives him some genuine moments where the priest does believe what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give him that.
Yeah.
He's not a clown like Crusoe was. But overall, I do think he's exposed. And I think in the same way, Simone Signore, who plays the prostitute, we can see that she does have her moments of care, and then she has her moments of duplicitousness and conniving, and that is exposed at the end. They're basically laid bare at the end. Similarly, the older miner, who we think is the most good-hearted person, he loses his mind.
Yeah.
That's his punishment. So that leaves two people, and the miner, we should say, is played by Charles Vanel. That leaves two people, Michelle Girardon, who plays his daughter, his mute and deaf daughter,
mm-hmm.
and then this mercenary played by Georges Marchal. Marchal gets left off the hook because...
You have to say his name. It's Shark.
It's
which
Shark,
I know was your nickname in high school.
Yes, and I it's weird. I spelled it the same way.
Uh-huh.
He's left off the hook because he's up front from the start that he's all in it for himself,
right?
He doesn't try to fool anybody. And then the daughter, I think she's left off the hook because, well, she's this handy stand-in for naivete and the powerlessness mm-hmm. of innocence. So this vice, this Buñuelian vice, comes down on these characters so funnily, I have to say, and darkly in that final scene where what was this exotic adventure along the lines of Casablanca or African Queen very much becomes a Buñuel film in its last 10 minutes.
Yeah, without a doubt. And it's funny that you mention Casablanca and the African Queen, because I think the movie it's more closely related to is another one I know you connected it to, because I saw your tweet in response to this film. You mentioned Casablanca and To Have and Have Not. And I don't know if I hadn't read that tweet, how vivid that would have been in my mind as I started watching this film, because I did watch it after I saw that comment. But it's very similar. The exotic locale, mm-hmm. the use of boats, the prominence of boats in the plot. And Shark really is the bogey mercenary character. And Jin, who is played by Simone Signore, she even looks like Lauren Bacall
Yeah, she does.
I maybe have seen her in another movie, but...
We've seen her in La Ronde in our Max Ophuls marathon. She played a prostitute there and gave quite a performance.
Well, she has a face that does remind me of Lauren Bacall, and there are even some of those double entendre kind of moments that you get between Bacall and Bogey, between Jin and Shark in this film.
I kind of thought of Jin as the Bogey character the more I watched this. I mean, he is in terms of masculinity, obviously, but in terms of her already existing in this community and having her role to play and playing the soldiers off the villagers, she's kind of in this in-between land that Bogey often is in. So.
Yeah, that's true. Buñuel doesn't call as much attention to it in terms of the pauses or the close-ups the way Hawks does, but in some of that dialogue between Bogey and Bacall, we get some of those very famous sexy lines, and here we get an exchange like the one where they meet for the first time. He's laying in her bed, and she all of a sudden shows up next to him because it's her bed and he's looking for a place to stay for the night, and he gets out the money because she says, "That's what I need from you," and he hands her some and she says, "No small bills," and he says, "You get a lot of big ones," and she says, "Not as many as I'd like." And maybe I'm reading into the translation there of the language, but
that's
how
they play it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they're going for there. So there are some of those pleasures in this film. And it's funny, I saw a few comments from some of the different reviews online that all talked about the plot maneuvering and how it's a little cumbersome. I didn't really feel that way. I thought it was really effective.
I thought it was fleet.
Yeah,
I mean, it does set up the positions in the village, I guess, for a little bit.
Yeah.
And we get the revolution, but there's even some interesting things going on there where Buñuel very carefully stages a lot of procession and a lot of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's repeated where these soldiers are either, you know, lined up to assassinate one of the miners or come marching into town together. And it's almost like the machination of oppression. He really communicates well in those early scenes. And then you can feel that, I think, on top of these characters when they do flee into the jungle.
For sure. Now, you're absolutely right that it really becomes a Buñuel film once they get into the jungle, once they have to flee. That's where you realize very quickly that this is not going to be your typical Hollywood action flick, and it's not going to offer some of those pleasures that a movie like To Have and Have Not does. It really becomes, more than anything, to throw out another reference, Herzogian, in the way it uses the jungle as its own oppressive force. And another movie I'll throw out that I was reminded of that came out about 20 years later, William Friedkin's Sorcerer, where you see a character lose his mind on a journey, the way we see the Castan character here also go mad. But once they are outside of the confines of society, oppressive or not, they do know their role. And so they each do what they have to do to survive within the confines of that role and that structure. Once they get into the jungle, everything that defines their personalities basically disintegrates. So Buñuel, of course, heightens that, but we talk about the cynicism and the sense of man and his weaknesses that comes through in these films. You're absolutely right that there comes a moment in this film where they all think they've found their salvation, and they are in search of their salvation. Of course, it's Buñuel. It's going to be a religious theme movie on some level. And what happens after that? That happiness is immediately undercut and subverted by madness and by pain. There's always going to be some suffering that is going to be at the core of these films.
And pettiness, just plain human pettiness.
Yeah, and you're going to get a moment like the one you do where when they think they've found that salvation, one character has to point out, well, we were saved, but in order to be saved, 50 other people had to die.
Yeah, I almost wish that line wasn't in there, because as he's panning over the plain, and I think there's one moment where a few of them come across the bodies. We don't see, but don't they pause and they look and kind of gasp and then turn away?
Yeah.
That, you know, that sunk in for me. I wish someone didn't have to say it as well.
It worked for me because it just seems so appropriate to this filmmaker that in that moment he would feel compelled to remind all of us that in order for some people to survive and be happy, there is going to be someone on the other end of that that had to suffer to make it happen.
So we talked about surrealism in regard to Buñuel in relation to A Nightmare on Elm Street last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things we discussed is how juxtaposition is an element of surrealism. And I think this image of the plane and these luxury items in this jungle is exactly that sort of surrealism, where there's a narrative reason for it happening, but it's still jarring to see these two things together. And the moment where Jin dresses up and puts on makeup as if she's going out for a night on the town because she's found these clothes laying in the jungle, yet she's still standing in the jungle. So that's
that disconnect is really fascinating.
That works. And there are a couple other Buñuelian moments or images that I think are worth mentioning. And one is when they're starving and Shark finds a snake and he's skinning it and then drops it on the ground. And we get this insert shot of just a few moments later, it's already being devoured by ants. Okay, back to bugs.
Well, and it's not even entirely clear that that's really happening.
Or that, is that what they're imagining?
Yeah, because there are many references priest character to might bugs be imagining.
That, they frequently mention how they're just tormented by the bugs. So that's that's a real jarring
but being eaten
image.
Alive.
Yeah.
Suffering like that snake is, that feels so appropriate to those characters in this environment.
And another very delicate one is when the father, the older miner, played by Vanel, he has this photo
I love this moment.
Of Paris, right? It's cars going around the Arc de Triomphe, and it's actually, it's not a photo. We first see it as a live shot of cars driving around the Arc, and then it transitions into this photo of the same image that he's holding, and we've learned already he's talked about his dream of opening a restaurant in Paris. And so he's holding this, and this is just about when he's starting to lose his mind, and he tosses it into their campfire. But just that transition from the live shot of the cars to the photo to the tossing of it in the fire is just so smooth and elegant and does what maybe a dialogue between the two characters could have done, but in such a more interesting way.
Elegant's a good word, but it is elegantly jarring, and it's jarring because we are stuck in this jungle with them with really no hope of getting out, right? And in a flash, all of a sudden, we're in Paris with the Arc de Triomphe and all these cars going by. We're in the City of Lights. And it so captures how vivid that dream must be in Castan's mind. I didn't even think about the fact that he's starting to lose his mind. So who knows if for a second he might actually think he is in Paris.
Right. But it could be.
In that moment, we're watching him. We are looking at Paris, and we are certainly aware of not only how vivid the dream is, but how unattainable it is. As soon as they come back out into the reality of that jungle, we know he's never getting to Paris. But also, it is jarring, and it's so effective because it's one of those brilliantly subversive moments. Because even though it didn't make any sense at all, there was nothing to explain how it could happen. For a second, I really believed that Buñuel was transporting us to Paris.
Yeah, because that's how movies usually work.
Right, that something happened. They did get out, and we were going to now hear the story of how they made it out alive and how he achieved his dream. For that second, I did buy it, and as soon as I finally accepted it, he then immediately throws us back into the jungle. So I'm with you completely that that is one of the more effective moments in the film. If you're out there and you did watch this movie, you're participating in the marathon, and you listen to this discussion, and you were intrigued, and you want to hear more, I did find some details about the DVD version of this film, and I don't know if it's the DVD you had or not. I watched it on demand, so I didn't have access to this, and I wouldn't have had time to partake anyway, but as we were talking about context off the top, there is apparently a commentary track on the DVD by a scholar who gives a lot of biographical information, and he draws some parallels between some of the events and motifs in Death in the Garden to other films from Buñuel's canon. So that might be interesting if you're intrigued by that. This marathon is brought to you by our friends at Mubi, and this film, like Robinson Crusoe, were both available for the past 30 days or so via Mubi. If you didn't get a chance to catch those movies via Mubi, there are still a lot of great titles. Every day they add a new one to the platform, and you have 30 days to watch it. And I love one of the two films we're highlighting this week, Josh.
Infernal Affairs, right? That's
indeed
a great one. This week and next, Mubi is celebrating Hong Kong dreamboat Tony Leung with two thrilling masterpieces of genre cinema. In Infernal Affairs, Leung meets his match across the line of the law in superstar rival Andy Lau. Of course, Infernal Affairs inspired two sequels and was remade as Martin Scorsese's The Departed. Mubi is also in the middle of Horrific October. This is a feature of their favorite horror films all throughout the month. It's focusing on double features. Recently, Mubi launched two great double bills. One of Jesus Franco, that would include The Demons and Female Vampire, and one that is an homage to silent horror films, that includes Nosferatu and The Hands of Orlok.
As I said, every day Mubi's curators introduce a new title and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $4.99 a month. Plus, when you use their mobile app, you can download films to watch offline. Listeners of Film Spotting get to try Mubi free for a month. Just go to mubi.com/filmspotting. That's mubi.com/filmspotting to redeem now.
Speaking of Horrific October, we're still hearing from listeners who have written in and shared voicemails about their scariest movie moments from their childhood.
Yes.
That's the list you and I put together on last episode with director Ty West. So if you want to continue sharing those or any comments about Moonlight, if you've caught up with that, or Death in the Garden, you can send those to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave that voicemail, 312-264-0744. That number is under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Adam's at filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film.
Also at filmspotting.net is where you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, we hope you'll vote in the current Film Spotting poll. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. A great new double bill coming from the folks at The Next Picture Show, pairing together an old movie and a new release, as they always do, discussing My Own Private Idaho, a film I love, and American Honey, the latest from Andrea Arnold.
My Own Private Idaho, a film we did a Sacred Cow review of within the last year and a half, right?
Yeah, the past couple of years, both very favorable on that Gus Van Sant film. Out in wide release this weekend, Doctor Strange, which Josh can recommend, Hacksaw Ridge, the latest from Mel Gibson, the World War II film starring Andrew Garfield, and Trolls, an animated film featuring voice work from Justin Timberlake, Zooey Deschanel, and the goddess Anna Kendrick. I have to line up. I'm going to have to go see this movie, aren't I?
Now that this is finally out, can we stop hearing that song? That
Which
JT
one?
Song?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I'm good with that.
Okay.
Is that from Trolls?
Yes, it's
okay.
From Trolls.
I had no idea. I'm out of touch with the kids these days, Josh. Out in limited release, Gimme Danger. This is the Stooges doc from Jim Jarmusch. I would like to see that film. And Tower, highly, highly recommended, a Film Spotting Golden Brick nominee. Next week on the show, Josh and Michael Phillips will be here to review maybe three films, maybe seven films. We don't know. But among them, very likely Arrival from Denis Villeneuve, starring Amy Adams, and Loving.
I'm going to promise those two. Loving and Arrival will have you covered there.
I look forward to listening.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is by Anderson Paak. More information is at AndersonPaak.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.